Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have stories from Bruce Alpert and Anne Ball, Phil Dierking, and me. Later, we'll listen to the fourth and final part of the American story, The Blue Hotel, by Stephen Crane. But first,
Deputy Attorney General Rob Rosenstein gave his reason for naming a special counsel to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 election. Trust. Rosenstein said it is important Americans have full confidence in the outcome of the Russian investigation. For that to happen, Rosenstein said, he needed to name a person who exercises a degree of independence from the normal chain of command. That person is Robert Mueller, a former federal prosecutor and FBI director. His selection Wednesday was praised by both Democrats and Republicans. Rosenstein's order says Mueller can investigate Russia's efforts to interfere with the presidential election, possible connections between Russia and Trump campaign officials, and any other matters that arise directly from the investigation.
Mueller will have more independence than the 94 U.S. attorneys who normally oversee criminal investigations. But he won't have complete independence. Mueller, unlike other federal prosecutors, will not be subject to day-to-day supervision by the Attorney General and other Justice Department officials. But the Deputy Attorney General can overrule his prosecutorial or investigative decisions. Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, is overseeing the Russian investigation because Attorney General Jeff Sessions removed himself. Sessions withdrew because he worked on the Trump campaign and met with Russian officials.
Mueller's appointment came after some unexpected developments in the Russia investigation. Last week, President Donald Trump dismissed FBI Director James Comey, who was overseeing the FBI's collection of evidence. The dismissal was followed by reports claiming that Trump had asked Comey to drop an investigation of his former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. Another report said Trump had asked Comey if he would be loyal to him. The White House denied both claims, but some Democrats say Trump should be investigated for obstruction of justice.
John Barrett is a law professor at St. John's University in New York. Barrett had earlier worked for a special federal prosecutor. He said obstruction of justice is a complex law. Among other things, it makes it a crime to obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding for corrupt reasons. Barrett said Trump's actions should be investigated. It will depend on whether Comey and others saw Trump's comments as threats, Barrett said. Special counsels have only been named twice. The last time was in 2003, when prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald investigated who leaked the identity of a CIA officer Valerie Plame. Watergate is the best-known case involving a special prosecutor. Archibald Cox was appointed to investigate whether President Richard Nixon had obstructed justice. The case centered on whether Nixon covered up his administration's involvement in the 1973 break-in at Democratic headquarters in the Watergate building. Nixon resigned from office in 1974 as Congress was ready to begin proceedings to remove him from office.
Another well-known case was the investigation of President Bill Clinton by Kenneth Starr. It started out as an investigation into a real estate deal known as Whitewater, but it led to Starr reporting that Clinton had covered up an affair with a White House intern. Special prosecutors had more independence than a special counsel, the job Mueller now has, but the law establishing the prosecutor position ended in 1999. The Mueller investigation probably will not be finished quickly. The Washington Post reported that, on average, previous investigations by special counsels or prosecutors took a little over 3 years. Ari Fleischer, the press secretary during the George W. Bush administration, tweeted Thursday that Mueller will not take any more time than needed. Starr was 48 when named special prosecutor, he tweeted. Fitzgerald was 43 when named special counsel. Mueller is 72. He won't want this to take years. I'm Bruce Alpert.
And I'm Ann Ball.
In 1980, American graffiti artist Jean-Michel Basquiat was selling his drawings for $50 each. This week, his painting Untitled sold in New York for $110.5 million. Only 10 works of art have sold at auction for more than $100 million. Basquiat's painting sets a new record for price of a work by an American artist. An Andy Warhol painting called Silver Car Crash was sold in 2013 for $105 million. The painting, Untitled, is of a skull-like head against a blue background. It last sold more than 30 years ago for $19,000. Japanese billionaire Yosaku Maezawa bought Untitled at Sotheby's Auction House on Thursday night. Basquiat was a street artist who became famous in the early 1980s. He died of a drug overdose in 1987 at the age of 27. He was known for using bright colors, words, and mixed materials in his work. His art captured the imagination of many artists, gallery owners, and musicians in New York City. Fans and supporters included Andy Warhol, David Bowie, and gallery owner Larry Gagosian. At one time, Basquiat's girlfriend was music star Madonna. Maezawa is a big fan of Basquiat. He bought another Basquiat painting for more than $57 million last year. Maezawa said he will loan the painting to museums around the world before displaying it in his hometown of Chiba, Japan. I hope it brings as much joy to others as it does to me, and that this masterpiece by the 21-year-old Basquiat inspires our future generations, Maezawa said. Grégoire Billot is the auction company's head of modern art. He said he has never seen so much emotion in a painting. He's bringing something never seen before, Billot said.
Several American cities are identified with a kind of music. For example, New Orleans is known for jazz, Nashville claims country music, and Memphis calls itself the home of the blues. Washington, D.C. is also known for a unique sound, go-go music. Go-go is often called the heartbeat of D.C. Most musicians and historians credit the birth of go-go music to Chuck Brown, a Washington, D.C.-born musician who died in 2012. Brown and his band, the Soul Searchers, started their career playing mostly funk and rhythm and blues music. The songs got people up and dancing. But Brown did not like it when people left the dance floor at the end of a song. So he decided to keep a beat going on percussion instruments after the song was over. Over time, this beat music became just as popular as the songs themselves and led to the creation of go-go music. The music gets its name from how the music, like the beat, goes and goes without stopping. Many consider go-go a kind of funk music. Big Tony Fisher is the lead singer of the band Trouble Funk in D.C. The band is one of the first go-go bands in D.C.
There's so many different elements, you know, to describe go-go music, because it's one of those types of music that you can pretty much mix with any other genre of music, you know what I'm saying? From reggae to jazz to blues.
Experience Unlimited, or EU, is another DC go-go band. EU drummer William Juju House says the percussion beat is critical to the music style.
The most important two pieces in go-go is the drummer and the congo player. And the reason that is the rhythms that are played between the two gives go-go its definition.
The rhythms of the two instruments are syncopated together, and any other kind of music style will play on top of that beat. With go-go, each song flows to the next without stop, all connected by this beat. Fisher says the conga sound itself is like a language.
It goes all the way back to our African tribe. It's just like the rhythm of the congos, it speaks to the body, and the kick drum syncs up with the heartbeat.
The other main feature of go-go is the relationship between the lead singer and the crowd. During go-go songs, the lead singer calls out questions to the audience. The crowd answers.
We got our little thing where, you know, where the crowd is actually the other part of the band. Where y'all from? And they all shout what area they from. You know, y'all tired yet? Hell no. Are you ready to go? Hell no. Do you want some more? Hell yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, the people get a chance to interact.
Experience Unlimited conga player Maurice Mighty Mo Higgins, says the call and response is also linked to African people.
Call and response has a lot of history. You know, it goes all the way back to African cultures, communicating with the drum, becoming as one.
As go-go grew in popularity, the music became a major presence in the city. DC bands would play for political gatherings and events to raise money for aid groups. However, despite go-go's deep history and popularity in Washington, D.C., the music's survival was threatened in the 1990s. That was the time drug-related crimes spread widely in Washington, D.C. Some of the crimes took place at go-go shows, with the bands getting the blame. Sometimes, crimes were falsely blamed on the bands. Big Tony Fisher says the media once linked Trouble Funk to a shooting at a DC show while the band was touring in London at the time. Urban development in DC also makes it harder for go-go bands to reach their audiences, says EU conga player Mighty Mo Higgins.
There are a lot of clubs that don't exist anymore because of new growth in the city. You got more bands, but less venues to perform at. So yeah, it had a big impact on the go-go scene.
However, go-go remains a beloved part of DC culture, and the musicians like Fisher are hopeful about keeping the music alive.
We're not gonna let it die. In the words of Martin Luther King, we will overcome.
I'm Phil Dierking.
The Blue Hotel, Part 4.
The Swede's face, fresh from Johnny's blows, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the whipping snow. A number of square shapes appeared before him, and he recognized them as the houses of the town. He traveled along a street until he found a saloon. He pushed open the door and entered. At the end of the room, four men sat drinking at a table. The Swede dropped his bag upon the floor and, smiling at the saloon keeper, said,
"Give me some whiskey, will you?"
The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of ice-filled water upon a table. The Swede poured himself an extra large amount of whiskey and drank it down.
"Bad night,"
remarked the saloon keeper without interest. He was acting as though he were not noticing the man, but it could have been seen that he was secretly studying the remains of blood on the Swede's face.
"Bad night,"
he said again.
"Oh, it's good enough for me,"
replied the Swede as he poured himself some more whiskey.
"No,"
continued the Swede,
"this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me."
The large drinks of whiskey made the Swede's eyes watery, and he breathed a little heavier.
"Well, I guess I'll take another drink,"
said the Swede after a while.
"Would you like something?"
"No, thanks. I'm not drinking. How did you hurt your face?"
The Swede immediately began to talk loudly.
"Oh, in a fight. I beat the soul out of a man at Scully's Hotel."
This caught the interest of the four men at the table.
"Who was it?"
asked one.
"Johnny Scully, son of the man who owns the hotel. He will be nearly dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I beat him well, I did. He couldn't get up. They had to carry him into the house. Have a drink."
Instantly, the men, in a quiet way, surrounded themselves in privacy.
No, thanks,
said one. It was a strange group. Two were well-known local businessmen. One was a lawyer, and one was a gambler. But a close look at the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the other men. He was, in fact, so delicate in manner and so careful with whom he gambled that the men of the town completely trusted and admired him. His business was regarded with fear and lack of respect. That is why, without doubt, his quiet dignity shone brightly above the quiet dignity of men who might be merely hat makers or builders or salesmen. Beyond an occasional unwise traveler who came by rail, this gambler supposedly cheated only careless farmers who, when rich with good crops, drove into town full of foolish pride. Hearing at times of such a farmer, the important men of Romper usually laughed at his losses. And if they thought of the gambler at all, it was with a kind of pride of knowing he would never dare to attack their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was known that this gambler had a wife and two children in a nice little house, where he led a perfect home life. And when anyone even suggested that there was a fault in his character, the men immediately described the virtues of his family life. And one must not forget to declare the bare fact of his entire position in Romper. It is true that in all affairs other than his business, this card player was so generous, so fair, so good, that he could be considered to have a higher moral sense than 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with two local businessmen and the lawyer. The Swede continued to drink whiskey and to try to make the saloon keeper drink with him.
Come on, have a drink. Come on. No? Well, have a little one then. By God, I've beaten a man tonight, and I beat him good, too. Gentlemen,
the Swede cried to the men at the table,
have a drink?
Shh, quiet,
said the saloon keeper. The group at the table, although really interested, had been trying to appear busy and talk. But now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly,
thanks. We don't want any more.
At this reply, the Swede straightened.
Well,
he shouted,
it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me. I want someone to drink with me now. Now! Do you understand?
He struck the table with his hand. Years of experience had hardened the saloon keeper. He merely answered,
I hear you.
Well,
cried the Swede,
listen then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch.
Stop that,
shouted the saloon keeper.
Why should I?
Demanded the Swede. He walked to the men's table and by chance laid his hand on the shoulder of the gambler.
What about it?
He asked angrily.
I asked you to drink with me.
The gambler simply turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
My friend, I don't know you.
Never mind,
answered the Swede.
Come and have a drink.
Now, my boy,
advised the gambler kindly,
take your hand off my shoulder and go away.
He was a little, thin man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone to the big Swede. The other men at the table said nothing.
What? You won't drink with me, you little fool? I'll make you then. I'll make you.
The Swede had grasped the gambler fiercely at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men jumped up. The saloon keeper ran toward the table. There was a great scene of shouts and movements, and then a long knife appeared in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body was cut as easily as if it had been a piece of fruit. The Swede fell with a cry of greatest surprise. The businessman and the lawyer must have rushed out of the place backward. The saloon keeper found himself hanging weakly to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer.
Henry,
said the latter,
you tell them where to find me. I'll be home waiting.
Then he left. A moment afterward, the saloon keeper was in the street, racing through the storm for help and, more important, companionship. Months later, the cowboy was cooking meat on the stove of a small cattle farm near the Dakota border when there was the sound of a horse stopping outside. The Easterner entered with mail and newspapers.
Well,
said the Easterner at once,
the fellow who killed the Swede will spend 3 years in prison. That's not much, is it?
He will? 3 years?
The cowboy turned the meat in the pan.
3 years? That isn't much. No,
replied the Easterner.
There was a lot of sympathy for him in Romper.
If the saloon keeper had been any good,
said the cowboy thoughtfully,
he would have gone in and hit that Swede on the head with a bottle in the beginning of it. That would have stopped all this murdering.
Yes, 1,000 things might have happened,
said the Easterner sharply. The cowboy moved his pan of meat on the fire, continued with his philosophy.
It's strange, isn't it? If he hadn't said Johnny was cheating, he'd be alive this minute. He was an awful fool. I believe he was crazy.
I feel sorry for that gambler,
said the Easterner.
So do I,
said the cowboy.
He doesn't deserve 3 years in prison for killing that fellow.
The Swede might not have been killed if everything had been honest.
Might not have been killed,
exclaimed the cowboy.
Everything honest? When he said that Johnny was cheating and acted so crazy, and then in the saloon he practically asked to get hurt?
With these arguments, the cowboy made the Easterner angry.
You're a fool,
cried the Easterner fiercely.
You're a bigger fool than that Swede. Now let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. Listen. Johnny was cheating. Johnny,
said the cowboy blankly. There was a minute of silence, and then he said strongly,
oh, no. The game was only for fun. Fun or not,
said the Easterner,
Johnny was cheating. I saw him. I know it. I saw him. And I refused to stand up and be a man. I let the Swede fight alone, and you were simply jumping around the place and wanting to fight. And old Scully, too. We are all in it. This poor gambler just got pulled into it. Every sin is the result of shared effort. We, 5 of us, have shared in the murder of this Swede. You, I, Johnny, old Scully, and that fool of an unfortunate gambler came merely at the end of a human movement and gets all the punishment.
The cowboy, hurt and angry, cried out blindly into this mystery of thought.
Well, I didn't do anything, did I?
That's all the time we have today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.